This is Critical Nonsense, our high lowbrow show about culture, science, and tech. This week, special guest Dylan asks us about queer comedy, and Joey asks us about China, the NBA, and other lighthearted geopolitical conflict.
Woo! Oh, it's me. It's Joey. And this is what I sound like. And importantly, this week we have many special guests. We have special guest Dylan Fowler, and this is what he sounds like.
Hi, hello. It's me.
It's me, Dylan. We have Osei Kwache in the house.
So wonderful to be here.
God,
so smart.
Osei's voice is so smooth, so good on a microphone. It's like me grading chalkboards. And then we have executive producer and future Abu, Jess Vander.
Hi, this is Jess. Future Abu. Have y'all thought about like what you would be called to, like, you know, what your nieces and nephews and whatever grandchildren will call you?
My niece just calls me JoJo because that was like how she could say my name when she's almost 13 now and still just calls me JoJo. But it's like, it's not like JoJo. It's like JoJo. Like,
do you think that ever graduates to like Uncle Joe?
She's never called any of us uncles.
Oh,
or aunts. Interesting. Yeah, like it's weird because my sister was 19 when she was born, and so my little brother is only like 11 years older than her. So they're more like siblings in some ways.
Yeah.
And I mean, they like fight like siblings, like in a playful way, and so yeah, I don't know. But grandparent, I mean, I thought about like the dad part too of like, do I just want to be dad or do I want to be like pop, pop?
I feel like in some level, the kid kind of decides.
Yeah.
I mean, not that young, but eventually for sure. Like, you know, the people who like call their parents by their first name.
I've always
like
thought
Mary
so Jo
or Beth. Yeah. And you're like, ooh, mm-mm. I don't know.
No. Hey, Margaret, give me a snack. So, you know, we have a lot of things to talk about today.
We just
draw that line right now, sharp.
Yeah.
Transition. This was a segue. We have Dylan in here. Do we have any housekeeping?
No.
We're having a live show. Surprise. We'll tell you more. Intrigue.
We'll leave it there.
Yeah. So we have Dylan here who 2 days ago over lunch started to bear his heart, and I just felt like it needed to be recorded in perpetuity in audio.
That's what lunch does to me. I'm just bearing my heart left and right. Yes, it's true. We were in the kitchen. We were talking about Saturday Night Live, I believe. And you said that you had seen a sketch that Bo and Yang did this past week, which it spoke to me. Like, honestly, him being on SNL has just been inspiring me. I in no way am a comic expert,
aficionado.
I guess. No way. But I've always been inspired by SNL, even comedians like Will Ferrell. I like grew up, you know, I feel like my personal comedic time, it's like based on that.
Yeah.
So I've just been thinking about comedy today and how many queers are in comedy these days.
All
it just warms my queer
comedy.
Little heart. And yeah, so I, you know, Bowen is one who is kind of in the forefront right now because he just joined SNL and he is, I think, the first Chinese American person to be on SNL.
Mm-hmm. East Asian person.
Wow, that's shocking.
Wow.
Yeah.
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 Maybe not to be on it, but as like a permanent cast member anyways. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And he is only the third gay male to be on SNL, which also is
also
shocking.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know. I mean, Saturday Night Live is a straight man's world.
Yeah,
you know,
it's true.
It really is. You know? And it has been since the 70s when it started, I think.
Which is ironic because some of the most legendary cast members, like many of the most legendary cast members are women.
Yeah, definitely. But I've been wondering, how is the queer community shaping modern comedy and how that is affecting the future of comedy, really? Let's look at the future.
So I clearly have no authority in this subject, but I think it's like such a interesting question. And I think, you know, some of the conversations we've had in the past, Osei, about sort of the way that power dynamics play into comedy of sort of whether subjugated people or like classes of people that are sort of not in the power seat in culture in general seems to be a place where comedy really flourishes, like the sort of unfortunate dynamics of being feeling like less than or feeling like the power structures are not in your favor. Well, you know, I think we can all agree we wouldn't want it to be that way, still is sort of like a pressure cooker for great comedy.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I mean, in terms of power dynamics, comedy feels appropriate, or it feels like almost like a form of justice when the punching is kind of happening in an upward direction.
Yeah.
So when you're punching up, it feels like, okay, this is appropriate. But when the punching is, you know, feels like it's coming down, that's when it's like, whoa, maybe we should pump the brakes a little bit on this. Maybe we've gone a little too far.
Yeah. Don't beef down. Right.
Yeah.
Like that's the consistent refrain against Drake beefing at lesser rappers.
Yes, don't exactly.
Beef
down.
Wait, beef, like I've got beef.
Yes.
Yeah, with what does that mean?
Lesser
exactly?
Rappers?
That's... Yeah, like don't fight with people who are.
Yeah, like fight somebody
it's
your
like,
own
that's
size.
Not fair. Yeah.
Okay, got it.
But there's an interesting part of this too, because so much there like is a current sort of position that like everyone is sort of reflexively reacting to political anything, right? Like anything that is political, everyone's like, whoa, now I got to take a side. But I feel like comedy is always political. I read a paper recently. I'll go back and see if I can find it. It was just a dissertation that someone shared post Dave Chappelle's special. And it was basically just like, comedy is always political. Like you're inherently like looking for some sort of tension to dig into and exploit for humor. And like that is always going to be political, even if you say it's innocuous. And I think queerness has been consistently political in culture. And so it makes sense that those two things at like a time where we're grappling with it culturally, like queer comedians are emerging and like, you know, being highlighted.
Yeah. I mean, Dylan, who are like, when you think of like, the top queer comedians today and like what they're doing, who comes to mind and what are they doing?
Yeah, I was thinking about that. And it's funny because I think that there are tiers of that, of like, if you're researching comedians, then you would know a lot of queer comedians. But if you're just an average Joe, I mean, Kate McKinnon on Saturday Night Live is definitely one that, now, I mean, everybody kind of knows who she is.
Right.
I don't think everyone knows she's queer, which is sort of an interesting component of the conversation, where with Bowen Yang that you brought up, sort of in his emergence, I think, like, you know, we're going through his set of qualifiers or his like identifiers, right? Like the fact that he was Asian was the first thing that came up before he even got to do a show because of the other cast member who had racist comments on his podcast. But then the queerness sort of came out in like episode one that he did, right?
One thing that struck me about Bowen was his unapologetic flamboyancy, because I think that on Saturday Night Live or even in you know, like stand-up comedy, I think, well, and in the world, let's be honest, men are afraid of that flamboyancy because it, you know, says something about their sexuality. And Bowen, I mean, he comes out like, just so loud, you know, he's like, but he's got this like fully realized character. He's like waving his arms and he's saying things like, no fam, like, you know, he's just like so unapologetically himself. And that's why when he came out this past week, it was like, oh my God, that is me. And I, first of all, I'm not on Saturday Night Live yet. And I, you know, I'm very much unapologetically myself. And, but you don't see that in the media or you don't see that in the public eye as much.
Mm-hmm.
And
on that stage, like
on
SNL,
that stage especially,
it's a big
yeah,
deal.
Yeah. And you know, thinking about it, I wonder if Kate McKinnon is reeling it. I mean, I guess she's just unapologetically being herself.
Yeah.
Yeah. She's just not leading with that.
Right.
Part
it's
of her
like
identity.
Maybe isn't queer forward, even though that could or could not be a part of being a queer comedian. It's
right.
Like that. Does that have to be like a critical part of your identity? Not necessarily.
Right. Well, and even in like her movies and things, she never really has a romantic interest, or she, you know, is kind of.
What was that movie that she did with Mila Kunis? I feel like she.
Oh,
was
it about
is that
spies?
The one where,
yeah.
Oh,
by
I must have missed that one.
This
no
dating a spy or
yeah,
something.
Yeah, the spy I'm side dating. I don't know.
My spy side piece.
Yeah, let's write that movie,
yeah.
Please.
My spy, the spy who dumped me.
The spy who dumped yeah. me. Right. Which I did not see.
I feel like she was sexual in that. Role, but also in sort of like an absurd
thing to say.
What does that even mean?
Like she was sort of like thirsty in the role.
Okay.
You know what I mean? She was like, I think she like slept with or was like chasing after like one of the like bad guy, like hitman types of people and stuff like that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well,
so
after
maybe
that
thirstiness
reveal.
Doesn't necessarily equate, but maybe. I don't know.
So, yeah, I mean, even outside of SNL, back to your who has inspired me. Do you know Cole Escola? Do you know him?
The name sounds familiar, but I don't.
There is a show, Billy Eichner. He is another queer comedian.
Yeah.
And he, the Difficult People, that he was a Hulu show, I believe. Cole kind of got his like notoriety or like, you know, his name. I guess people can recognize him from that. But he's also on At Home with Amy Sedaris. And, His use of drag is his characters very often are women, and it's not like a joke. It's not like this is a man in drag. He just walks out and it's a woman.
Right.
Like there's not a bit. You know what I mean? And ways that I think, especially straight comedy, men dress up as women as the bit.
Right.
You know? Mm-hmm.
Right.
And so Cole is really inspiring to me because he. Again, unapologetic. That's a word of the day. All right. And he is very that. He's like, yeah, I'm doing this character as a woman and we're not going to talk about it. And that makes it funny, but it's not funny because of that. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, I think there have been some sort of significant moments, let's call it, over in the past decade anyways. I mean, there have been significant queer comedy moments before that as well, I think. But I think both sort of Hannah Gadsby's Nanette special was sort of like clearly a moment for her to talk about queerness in both making jokes, but also sort of making a statement forward special of like, I need to address this. This is a problem. And sort of somehow mixing both a very clear political message and statement as well as, you know, being both like heartwarming and funny at key points. Maybe not like laugh out loud funny necessarily in the way that you might expect going into a comedy special, but then also like Tig Notaro.
Yeah, I was thinking of Tig too. And also Wanda Sykes, let's be honest.
Yeah.
And she, I feel like, does talk about her being a lesbian in her comedy, you know, in a way that many people, also Margaret Cho.
Yeah.
You know,
I was thinking about Margaret Cho. There's Lia Delaria, I guess.
Yes.
From she's in Orange is New Black.
Yeah.
What's her character's name?
Big Boo.
Big Boo. Mm. Yeah. She was on Arsenio Hall a bunch in the 90s. And what was, and I didn't watch this at the time. This is just me doing research. But one of the interesting parts about she was on like four times in a year. And at the time, like queerness, you know, like Ellen was not out yet at that time. Like people weren't.
Ellen.
Ellen wasn't out yet. But she apparently, let me pull it up. She was just saying a bunch of queer words 47 times in 4 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And so like she was coming out and just being like, this is me. I'm here. Like, this is it.
Loud and proud.
Yeah, exactly. And no one was doing that at the time. Like, you couldn't do it. And so there is sort of like, you know, Bo and Yang is like standing on the back of giants in some ways. Like, he's sort of someone now who is getting to be in a spotlight, especially as someone who is sort of intersectional in some ways, of being the first East Asian cast member, and also, you said, only the third queer cast member,
like gay male.
Yeah. And so it is like interesting where we're getting to now, where he can do that potentially because of people like,
right,
Wanda.
Well, even behind the scenes on Saturday Night Live, we've been talking about Julio Torres, who is, I guess, a couple of years now been writing for Saturday Night Live. He's not a cast member, but he is changing that show and changing the way that we look at. It's not so much I'm sure he has credits everywhere, but the sketch part of it, he does a lot of the pre-recorded like segments. Mm-hmm. What are they called? You know, like.
Yeah, like the sketches that they do.
Right. Mm-hmm. He like Wells for Boys. I don't know if you guys remember that one, but it's like by Fisher Price, a well for sensitive boys. And it's like just this boy he's just like staring into the well. And this like, you know, straight little boy walks over and is like, that's weird. And the mom goes, this isn't for you. This is for him. Because he's like whispering into this well. And the dad goes, what's he doing? And she goes, sharing a secret. Like, it's just so subtle. But so, you know, he wrote a sketch about an actress who is a mom and is not a successful actress. And so she finally gets her big role as the woman who's cheated on in a gay porn. And she, like, her line is, what are you doing with my godson?
That's her big break right there.
That's her big break. And and in the length of this special or this segment, she's unlocking the character of this woman who's discovering that her godson is with her husband. And it's like just so thought provoking. It's so, again, introducing themes and introducing a way of laughing at that SNL has never done before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And part of it is also, you know, in a time where we're searching for new original creative work, it's like, of course, this is unexplored territory for the general public. It's new and funny because it's exciting material.
Yeah.
It's amazing because in many ways it's kind of forcing us to kind of like stretch our muscles a little bit, like, you know, expanding what we have the capacity to laugh at.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think what's interesting is like the diversity point, right? Like the diversity of perspectives is only going to make comedy funnier because it's going to like tickle you in new ways that you weren't expecting. And I actually saw Julio Torres when he was in New York, just at like a stand-up special that my friend like produces. And it was like not, you know, like an elite room, but as a room of, you know, 60 or 70 people type of thing. And he was just so unique. Like, it was so, I mean, he's an immigrant from Central America. Mm-hmm. He is queer, and he's just has this like completely different perspective. Very that was dry. So weird. And you could sense in the room that like as he's going through things, like everyone knows there's a joke coming, and he's already done one or two that like got everyone laughing. And so there's just like anticipatory, like, where is the joke going to pop out from and scare me? Right. Like, everyone is just like waiting for it because he's so like deadpan and flat. And like, it is like, you know, like your dad like waiting to tickle you, or like being like, I'm gonna do it. Yeah. Like, I'm gonna do it.
And it's like uncomfortable. Like, I feel when I watch Julio stand up uncomfortable, but it's not a negative uncomfortability. Mm-hmm. It's just like, okay, I'm hanging on his every word. What is he gonna say? You know, kind of just waiting for the punchline. But sometimes the punchline never even comes. And he knows it, you know, which makes it.
It's like a gambler scale. Like, you don't know the structure of the joke, you know, like gambler reward scale, where it's like, you attach to something more when you don't know when the reward is coming. So you keep doing a thing and like the reward could come later. Now it's like, why slot machines trick you? But with him, he's just like, you're waiting because you think you know the structure of the joke. And then all of a sudden the joke doesn't come. And somehow that's funny because the joke wasn't there.
Yeah.
You know, it's amazing to me just how much social power comedians have. Like a good comedian can control an entire room.
Yeah. Yeah.
Literally just by standing there and doing almost nothing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is why I want to know, final question, if folks have to go see like one special or like one show that they can look up on their subscription service or on YouTube or whatever, what should they go see that is like the best in queer comedy right now?
Oh, wow. Honestly,
Who? I know that's a hyperbole, so
I
no pressure or anything.
I know. There's this show on HBO that Julio wrote with Anna Fabrega, who it's called Los Spookies, and it's what? Have you guys watched it?
Yeah, it's so weird.
It's very that's Julio. He's the guy with the
that's the guy
the blue
you know,
hair.
Have you
yeah. very very funny?
My friend yeah. had us. Sorry, I got so animated because my friend got us to watch like two episodes of Los Spookies, and it was bizarre.
It's so weird, but it's very his comedy, and I hope that that's shaping how other people are making TV shows and are making specials, because it doesn't have to be in your face to be funny.
Yeah,
you know, and it also doesn't have to be a cheap, you know, poop joke or, you know, something like that.
Yeah, which though
I love a cheap poop joke, but
it's funny because I was like not gonna say something when Jess said who's like the queer special that you should see, but there was like Comedians of the World special that was on Netflix that was, you know, four comedians from different places in the world, and there's this British stand-up who is gay, and it was like part of his stand-up, like he wasn't like shying away from sort of some of like the tropes of just like being gay and vain or like needing abs, or like he did these things, but it wasn't like super in your face. And at the end he'd been talking about being picked on, and he was like talking about nunchucks the whole time, and he just pulled out nunchucks that both of the handles of the nunchucks were dildos, and just started like doing an entire martial arts scene on the stage. And I was like, that is like a super cheap joke, but I was like, what queer specials did you watch? I was like,
some classic queer comedy.
Spinning dildo nunchucks.
And that's all. That's all we'll have to say on this subject.
Sorry, that's NBA on TNT.
I'm trying to jump in.
Thematically appropriate.
Can we do the Shaq beef tracks? Just play Shaq's beef track into.
What about Space Jam? Welcome to the Space Jam.
Oh, wait, Space Jam 2 is coming out soon, right?
Oh, yeah.
Who's going to do the Space Jam 2 soundtrack?
I hope somebody really cool.
What if they get Quad City DJs back?
Oh, boy. Honestly, an incredible soundtrack that has held up, and a film that has not.
I disagree.
Not that recently. I somewhat recently, meaning like in the last 5 years, watched Space Jam as an adult, and I was like, no, I thought this was one of the top cinematic works.
No, the movie's like, awful.
Bugs Bunny's performance was derivative.
Dry.
Of his own work.
Of his own work, yes.
No, the acting in Space Jam 2 will be much better. LeBron's actually pretty good on screen.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. He was really funny in the Trainwreck. Amy Schumer movie.
Yeah. But also Bill Murray was in Space Jam.
Yeah.
That's a classic performance. Yeah. Also,
he doesn't play defense.
That guy from Jurassic Park who was really scary.
Jeff Goldblum?
I don't know his name.
Don't even.
Jeff Goldblum watches you poop.
I'm going to come back and talk about Jeff Goldblum.
Well, that's not a song, Jess, but that might be a palate cleanser of just talking about Space Jam.
Yeah.
So the reason Space Jam is coming up is because bam 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 geopolitics corner. Dun, 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 dun.
Corners.
Yeah. Dick Wolf is gonna come for us for that acapella version of
Law and Order.
Yeah, the next episode of Law and Order is going to be Dick Wolf taking us to court.
Whoa, meta.
Yeah, wow. Very. The reason the NBA is coming up is because the NBA is in the news.
Yes.
The news. What's the news?
Allow me to explain the news to you, Jess, okay, for cool. those unacquainted. So basically, I guess, oh, so you want to help me? We can set this up back yeah. and forth. Daryl Morey, the GM of the Houston Rockets, an NBA team, and probably, I mean, in the top tier of yeah. NBA GMs.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I'd say for NBA heads, Daryl Morey is a household name.
Yeah, he is like among one of maybe 2 to 3 people that yeah. you could make the case are like the best GMs in basketball.
Why would you even know that? Like, what does he do that is publicly visible?
Have you did you see the movie Moneyball with Brad Pitt?
No, but that was a book, right?
Yeah, it was.
Didn't read baseball. That either.
It was a book okay. by Michael Lewis. Talking about how Billy Beam, the general manager of the Oakland A's, essentially used stats to optimize the players that they went after in order to save money, and it was really effective in terms of helping the team win. Well, Daryl Morey is that for the NBA. Yeah. He is not a former player, which is rare for the GM position. Most GMs are former players. He was a stats guy who worked for a data science company, loves basketball, and managed to figure out how to optimize a basketball team using sabermetrics and statistics.
Yeah, he basically started the sports statistics conference, the MIT Sloan Sports Conference, that is now like a thing. People worship him that are like diehards. So he's the GM of the Houston Rockets. He tweets something, and maybe we can pull up the exact tweet, or do you know what the exact words were? It was like it was like a 6-word tweet about Hong Kong. I think he said something to the effect of
let me pull it up.
Fight for freedom. Stand with Hong Kong.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's pretty straightforward. Clearly,
seven words.
Yeah. There is political weight to what he said, but it was that was all it said, right? Mm-hmm. And the thing you need to know about the Houston Rockets and the thing that you need to know about the NBA in general is that the Houston Rockets are the biggest or one of the biggest, if not the biggest team in China. And basketball has become increasingly huge in China, arguably the top sport,
yeah,
like professional sport in China.
Houston, Texas. When you say biggest team in China, you mean they follow this team?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. They have a sizable fan base in China.
Oh.
Yeah. There are a number.
And I are like, I'm like, oh.
But are we going to get to why that is?
Yeah. Okay, there are great. A number of reasons why. The team is red. Which is not insignificant. I think uh-huh. they're in the same way that in the EPL, which is also big English Premier League soccer in China, the Manchester United is the favorite team. They're called the Reds. Red is a lucky color in China. It is the color on the flag, all of that. Uh-huh. But also because Yao Ming played for the Houston Rockets, who yep. is inarguably the most famous Chinese NBA athlete that's ever played in. Probably had the most prestigious oh, yeah. career as well.
Multi-time, all-star.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, you know, made multiple all-NBA teams.
Yeah.
And I believe the Rockets actually retired his number as well.
Yeah.
Wow. Oh, wow.
And now he has a significant position as like chairman or something to that effect.
The Chinese basketball.
Whoa.
So Daryl Morey puts out this tweet and it ignites a total shit storm. I mean, truly, the carry-on effects that have started to take off from this have been massive. The Chinese government releases a statement basically just saying, like, we are not okay with this. A bunch of sponsors that were affiliated. So the NBA has been pushing into China. They have a big deal with Tencent, which is the company that creates WeChat, which is basically Facebook in China.
They would say Facebook is like the Tencent in everywhere else.
Yeah. I mean, the order that they came is would be Facebook, but Tencent is more integrated into society than, I mean, you, if you're going to like buy a burger, at you would pay for it on WeChat. So the Tencent has the rights to play all of the basketball games in China, and they said, we're not showing Houston Rocket games. If you like signed up for a pass to watch Houston Rocket games, we'll refund you your money, or you can pick a different team because we won't be playing them. A bunch of sponsors pulled out their deals, or with, you know, in connection with the Houston Rockets in China. Things started like carrying forward. And there are more details that we can go into, but it's just turned into this like massive issue, because the One China policy, which is basically a internal policy within China, that Taiwan and Hong Kong, while having different sort of governmental structures than mainland China, are still, the stance is two systems, one China. And for anyone to say anything that conflicts with that is, you know, what would be considered a third rail topic. Like, you just can't say it in China. But where, you know, Daryl Morey's in America, we have freedom of speech. We have sort of the ability to criticize the government, criticize, you know, anyone who we see fit, with, you know, pretty limited sort of restrictions on that, outside of lying, and even that seems to not always be an issue. But it's a billions of dollars potentially fallout right now for the NBA based on this one man making this one tweet. And so my question is, you know, how do we manage company values like the NBA's value of freedom of speech in an increasingly global economy?
That is a really, really tough question. I mean, it really shows you just how difficult globalization is of a beast to just sort of like manage, because, you know, we all agree, hey, this money is valuable. I want, you know, additional customers. I want to expand, you know, the reach of my brand. But at the same time, you have to recognize that there are fundamental cultural differences that really play into how people perceive things. And like, yes, the NBA is an entertainment product, and it's very convenient for people to say like, hey, you know, let's just focus on the sports. But you can't really do that, because sports are inherently political. They always have been. You know, there are winners and losers. I mean, there are dynamics involved. I mean, even here in the United States, it's like teams decide where they're going to be situated based on their ability to wrangle taxpayer dollars. From local municipalities. So it's like sports are inherently political. So like, how do we navigate this at a time when, you know, a tweet can trigger like, you know, a geopolitical sort of like, you know, uproar?
Yeah. I mean, it's a single tweet that was taken down, and he, you know, I guess sort of pseudo apologized. He said, I'm sorry if I've offended people with, you know, he didn't walk back necessarily his opinion on the Hong Kong situation, but he apologized for offending people, and that so like aspect of it seems sincere. But there are potentially like a $1.5 billion like sort of carry-on effect of one person, like, you know, sitting on the toilet writing a tweet.
Well, I guess that's my question, though, is like, if we're talking about, you know, company values or like what the NBA has to deal with, you know, I guess the question is, do they see Daryl Morey as this guy who was just like, you know, like ruining them basically, or like, do they agree with him? Are they trying to protect him? Like, what's the deal with their skin in this game? Mm-hmm. Do they just feel like a helpless victim?
Yeah, I mean, I think we should also just do the sort of disclaimer that we've worked with the WNBA or with the WNBA in the past and the NBA, and so just as whatever, what would you call that? FYI.
Yeah.
But I think what's putting like an interesting point on this was the NBA does have what, at least potentially politically, the most sort of progressive culture of any of the major sports leagues in the US. They sort of promote the ability for athletes to have their own platform, to speak about things that are important to them that don't necessarily either match with the business interests of the NBA, or, you know, as long as it's probably not like radically conflicting with it.
Yeah, I mean, the NBA got a ton of brownie points, you know, amidst all of the Colin Kaepernick controversy with the NFL, because, you know, they allowed LeBron and Derrick Rose and a number of other players to, you know, engage in their own form of protest.
Yeah.
By wearing the t-shirts, you know, the Banana Boat crew got up on stage at the ESPYs and gave the statement about, like, you know, police brutality.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, yeah, the NBA has kind of garnered this reputation, at least in the last decade or so, of being very progressive and being open about allowing their players to use their voices.
Very pro-free speech, right? And so for this to come out, what happens is they have the vested interest with China of, like, yes, we want to export our product to a new market that, you know, in something, I think the deal initially where I said $1.5 billion, I believe it's $500 million over 3 years with Tencent to have it streaming. So it's a lot of money. And they didn't stop probably believing in free speech, but they were, you know, crossing cultural lines. And so you sort of have to now be sensitive to how other people feel or operate when your product has existed primarily in one culture and now is entering into a new culture that is quite radically different. And so they just, you know, naturally, like, it makes sense. Like, why would the NBA have a position on the One China policy? Like, they wouldn't be making public statements about it. But the sort of bigger issue becomes how sensitive China is to that particular topic.
Well, I mean, I think the challenge that the NBA has with this situation is it's unique to them because, unlike many of the other sports brands, they effectively have sub brands in the players.
Yeah.
The players are huge in the NBA. Like, if you go onto Instagram or Twitter, you know, LeBron James, Steph Curry, like, you know, the top players in the league, you know, on the Houston Rockets, James Harden, these guys have more followers than the teams they play for.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
So, like, people are following them.
Yeah.
So it makes it very challenging for the NBA because it's like, yeah, you know, they have, as a brand, they might have a position, but they don't have any control over how Russell Westbrook feels.
Yeah.
You know, how Kobe Bryant might feel about something like that. So, it does make it a difficult sort of position for them to be in.
Yeah. And what's interesting in this case is people in China love the NBA and the free speech issue is fine, but China has sort of like a zero tolerance policy on this particular subject right now because they feel like Hong Kong is seceding, independent of sort of, without getting into the actual Hong Kong situation, their perspective is Hong Kong is trying to secede, and that's what they're saying publicly. And so for an NBA manager to make a statement on the most popular team in China about free Hong Kong to them was effectively like an attack on their sovereignty is what their public statement has been. But their NBA actually has some leverage, right? Like, they are a big league, a massive financial institution that is capable of at least pushing back and balancing some of the conversation and sort of negotiating and walking through it. Activision Blizzard has a Hearthstone league, which is like a Warcraft card game that is an esport.
It's a video game.
Yes.
There we go.
Got it.
Activision Blizzard
is like the video game company.
That sounds like a Dr. Evil initiative.
Yeah.
You know? Activation Blizzard.
And my laser
beam. My laser beams.
Yeah.
But they have a huge interest in China, and China is a much larger portion of their total audience, right? Like, it is a much more central component to their sort of ability to generate revenue. And at a competition one of the top Hearthstone players did an interview where he said something. He's from Hong Kong, and he said something about the situation in Hong Kong. And they removed him from the league. They said he can't compete anymore. And they told him to pay back his prize money.
Ooh, that's wild.
Yeah.
And because China told them, like, do this or you can't be here effectively, you know, whether that was public or not, it was clear that they got a ton of pressure put on them and they don't have the same type of power. And so the question becomes, how do you, where you as a country in sort of a global economy have your own set of values and you operate within your own set of values, when you enter into one of these new economy, countries with its own distinct culture that may have points of conflict with your culture, like, how do you operate? And, like, you know, do you let go of certain values? Like, in the case of the NBA, like, increasingly Adam Silver said, like, we will fight for free speech, you know, in not an aggressive way necessarily, but, like, it's become clear that, you know, it, wherever this goes, like, we will uphold our, the ability for our players to say what they want. Whereas Activision Blizzard was just like, all right, well, sorry, see yeah. you guy, like, you know, you're gone. And yeah. and actually, like, give me money, please.
I feel like that the key is what was part of the original question, which is the global economy part, right? Yeah. Like, if in one space you won't succeed, but in another market you will, then, you know, you might have to cut losses even for just a short period of time while something, you know, maybe it'll blow over. Maybe, you know, the social sentiment will change in time, or maybe it won't. But if you have enough mass appeal to the world and, like, what you stand for, if other people can resonate with that, then you'll find your market. It just might not be in China.
Yeah. Yeah. It just might not be in China.
Well, yeah, I mean, but I think this is an issue that even tech companies are dealing with. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, Google's been trying to kind of lay their footprint in China as well, but they can't because of just all of the restrictions around privacy and data and all that stuff.
Yeah, I mean, what's interesting about this, and we can, you know, bring this to conclusion, is China is an interesting market in just its sheer scale, right? Mm-hmm. That there are 1.4 billion people or so in China. And so in some ways it can become a self-sustaining market just by the sheer volume of people. And the Chinese government, I mean, actively tries to keep it an enclosed market. And so, you know, companies outside of China see it as, like, this is an opportunity. There's 1.4 billion people in this country. Like, that is a market that we can go in and yeah. make money. Whereas China's like, we got 1.4 billion people, and if you want to come here, you have to play, like, strictly by our rules. Whereas that doesn't tend to be the case in as clearly in Western cultures. I'm sure it happens in different ways, but that sort of mono, like, you know, authoritarian, I guess, the head of the
autocratic man,
yeah, approach sort of create strictures that even, you know, U.S. companies just aren't even used to working within or may not anticipate, right? Like, the NBA's relationship with China is new, and it was in some ways almost inevitable that something, you know, you'd step in it some way, just you weren't expecting it to be, like, to put the entire relationship on the line because yeah, some guy tweeted
just seven words
from the toilet.
Just, you know, seeing some of the Rockets players at the press conference, I mean, there was a video that was circulated online of a reporter, you know, asking, I believe it was Russell Westbrook and James Harden,
yeah.
about, you know, the whole situation. And these guys are just kind of like, you know, looking in the other direction, hanging their heads. And eventually, I think a team representative came over and just took the microphone away from the journalist. I mean,
yeah.
it's clearly like a very, very sensitive issue that, like, nobody wants to talk about.
Yeah, everyone's like, I don't know what's going on.
I look forward to the day where in a textbook somewhere that some young student is going to read, it'll be like chapter 4. This guy named Daryl made like yeah. sent
the
a tweet
heard
yeah.
around the world.
Yeah, exactly.
Dude, I just I would like to see a video of just the situation he was in when it was actually happening and just being like the most banal thing.
Oh, no.
Thing.
Yeah. Oh, no.
Like, he's right. Like in his underwear, like his hair is like disheveled. He's like eating like a stale bagel.
Cheerios?
It, oh. Yeah. It makes you wonder, is like, is this moment going to be on the next page next to like Muhammad Ali refusing to enter the draft for the Vietnam War, or Jesse Owens winning, you know, the gold medal at the 1936 Berlin Olympics, like Daryl Morey tweeting on his toilet.
Yeah.
Headlines.
And he changes the world.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, Dylan, do you want to do a summary of that conversation? I just want to hear you as not basketball.
I learned so much.
And conclude this.
Conclude your segment.
Yeah.
China, basketball, NBA, and then it ended with another poop joke. I'm just going to say it.
Nailed it.
That is a beautiful poem by Dylan Feller. Critical nonsense.
Critical Nonsense is a Sylvain Labs production.
Recorded in beautiful MacGyver Studios. No, actually, Fox Studios.
In New York.
Also
New York.
New York, New York.
We'd like to thank
special guests Osei Quatre and also special guest Dylan Fowler for joining us on the show today.
We'd also, as always, like to thank executive producer and shooting guard Jess Vander.
Thanks, Joey. And special thanks to sound engineer Alex Contell for setting all of our stuff up in a different room than normal.
We'd like to thank designer Nora Mestrich for our cover art and for, you know, locking down the paint.
And with production help from Sarah Gilbert, Les Jacobs, and Tony Wong.
And as always, thanks, Alain.
Thanks.
I personally would like to thank Stefan Marbury.
Who is this?
Native of Brooklyn, New York. Played Brooklyn. In the NBA for many years. But when his NBA career ended, he went to China.
Yeah.
And he had a second career there that was absolutely amazing. Like, he is the Jordan of China.
Yeah, he had a renaissance. There's a statue outside of the Beijing arena of Stefan Marbury because he won them two titles.
Yeah. I mean, they even created a stage play musical about his life.
Oh,
but
boy.
He starred in it, right?
Yeah, he played himself.
Oh, boy. So, even better.
So, like, yeah, shout out to Stefan Marbury for proving that globalization can work.
Yeah, Beijing Ducks. He was the Starbury of the Beijing Ducks.
Yeah, from Brooklyn to Beijing.
The Mighty Duck.
A coming of age story. From Brooklyn to Beijing should have been the name of the musical.
I would like to thank both of you for having me here. First off,
God, you're so nice.
I'm saying
so
that hoping
you.
That you'll invite me back. I also would like to thank queers everywhere.
Thanks, queers.
Thanks, queers. Dylan, out.
I would like to thank Julio Torres's hair colors.
Ooh,
oh, do they change?
Yeah, freak
chameleon style.
Also, that little star that he has dangling from his ear a lot of the time. I'd like to thank that earring.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, is that your inspiration for your single earring look?
I hadn't thought about it, but maybe it,
Or maybe you're just original and maybe they're inspired by you.
Maybe
he saw you at a bar one time and was like, look at that man.
That statement earring is fierce.
Brooklyn queers. We're just all the same. You see one, you see them all.
As you have like your dyed hair right now and your one statement earring.
I am channeling Julio Torres right now.
I'm creating a story for myself where I was born in, where is he from? Honduras or Guatemala?
I don't even know.
Yeah.
I'm not going to pretend.
I would also like to thank Saturday Night Live.
I mean, honestly, let's thank Lorne Michaels.
Lorne?
You know.
I wish I could do a Lorne Michaels impersonation because every time I hear someone do one, I just think they're funny.
Yeah. Thank you, SNL.
Dylan, great job today. Sometimes you win it, sometimes you lose.
Wow.
It was not a good. It was not a good.
Is that how he sounds?
No. We'll work on it.
Yeah. Okay, we're going to workshop it on a comeback on a few episodes with a new and improved Lorne Michaels impersonation.
I would like to thank y'all for bringing us another basket sports episode.
Yeah. Sports baskets.
Yes. It's a sport where baskets are made, but not basket weaving.
Competitive basket weaving on ESPN 8.
Hey, have y'all?
The Ocho.
The Ocho.
Have y'all ever woven a basket before?
Yes.
No?
Oh my gosh. Twins. Yes. A. B. It's actually so fun.
Longaberger baskets.
Like a wicker basket?
Yeah.
You know, where just, you know, under, over. Yeah. Steam the wood pieces or like soak the wood pieces even better.
Wow.
Yeah.
Dye them different colors. Hold eggs in them.
Well, that is thanks. We have many to give, and you can use them at your leisure.
You can reuse our thanks.
Reusable thanks. Sustainability.
Brought to you by Critical Nonsense. Recording.
Oh my god, you guys are recording. Oh, hello.
I have to do my intro part.
Oh, we're not at that part of recording.